Well, good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. It is Friday, the 1st of March, and very nice to have you with us on this Friday. And we start a new month. This is the in like, is all right, in like a lion, not like a, is that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we'll see what happens.
I like March.
Yeah. Yeah, I like March. Yeah. Everything
the
sort
end
of.
End is in sight.
That's right. So welcome to March. Welcome to the roundtable. Welcome to our panel. And let me welcome our panelists. We have a great group this morning. Siena College Economics Professor Aaron Pisidia is with us. Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning, everyone.
Very nice to have you here, as always, sir. We have a lot to talk to you about today. Senior fellow and visiting professor at Bennington College, founder of Beyond Plastics, and former EPA Regional Administrator Judith Enck is with us. Good morning, Judith.
Good morning, and good morning, AMC listeners.
You seem to have fewer notes than you usually do.
Oh, that's it?
You have like a napkin. What? You usually have a whole book.
I know. I'm unprepared today.
You're streamlining, I think.
Yes.
That's all right.
I had meetings into the night last night, and I didn't prepare as thoroughly as possible.
For the listeners, Judith usually comes in with like a
one
a notebook.
Notepad.
Yeah, and it's usually she has very meticulous notes.
I keep it in the same notebook because I'm thinking like in a couple of years, I'll go back and see every week and what were the issues of the day. And
there you go.
I can write a book, Joe like, Donahue and Me.
It's like journaling. It's great. And Alan Chartok joins us. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Well, good morning. I'm doing okay. I'm glad Aaron Pisidia as well as Judith is here today, and I'll tell you why. I read the article, I think, in the New York Times yesterday, Aaron, in which they talked about whether the economy was doing good or bad. I read that article four times, and I have to tell you, I could make no sense out of it whatsoever. Either we're doing good or bad, but or the Times is just being properly critical of Trump. But I don't know. I just couldn't come away with a sense of it.
They're basically my read of it was we were in the last fourth quarter. We were up, although it was not expected. Although it was down from the time prior to that. And
exactly.
And how are we? What are we supposed to make of that, sir?
Okay.
Let's dig right in.
All right.
Aaron did bring a notebook, by the way.
Not only do I have a notebook.
Oh, you have spreadsheets.
I have a spreadsheet.
Now we're outed. People on the radio didn't know we were such dorks.
Yeah. Theater of the mind, Judith. Theater of the mind.
This is an improv club.
Don't worry about it. It's only when he brings his banjo that we have to.
Yeah, there you go.
Every four times a year, the Bureau of Economic Analysis releases probably the most comprehensive report on the state of the U.S. economy, and that's their Gross Domestic Product, or GDP, report, which looks at how the macro economy has grown as a whole. So you're looking at huge, huge aggregates, and the U.S. economy grew at 2.6% in the fourth quarter. Relative to where we were last year, that's a 3.1% increase in growth. So all in all, that's pretty consistent with an economy that is growing, but not growing as fast as Trump's economic team and Trump himself predicted, and because they were largely basing that on really overinflated estimates of the tax cut. So the Congressional Budget Office, which kind of does these long-term forecasts, thinks that the U.S. economy should be growing around 3.3% a year. So this came in well, well below those numbers. So there's nothing in that report that's particularly alarming. There's no signs of a looming recession, but there's no signs of the huge stimulative effect that Trump and his team were promising for the tax cuts. So the big news here is that business investment, which, you know, two-thirds of the $1.5 trillion tax cut were corporate tax cuts. So the argument is that, well, if you cut corporate taxes, that frees up more money for them to invest in new equipment, new structures, new factories, new machines, hire more workers, and that just was not there in the report. And it really hasn't been. And to a lot of economists, that's not a surprise because businesses usually don't respond to changes in taxes with respect to their investment plans. They primarily respond to more consumer demand, higher wages, and higher incomes. That's what drives business investment, not corporate tax rates. So the cut in corporate tax rates, you know, provided a huge boost to corporate profits. It provided a huge boost in dividend payments to shareholders. Most companies are using the benefits of the tax cut to buy back shares, which pushes up their stock prices and makes stockholders wealthier. And that was the goal of the Trump tax cut. That's not how it was sold to the public, but that was the goal. So investment should be growing around 20 to 30% a quarter based on what the White House estimates were, and it's growing around 1 to 2% over the last year. So we're not seeing the investment boom that that Trump was predicting. So to answer Alan's question, the U.S. economy is doing reasonably well. We're still growing. Those two big bumps we had in 2019 when the economy was growing at 4.2% and 3.4% are anomalous. We're going to look back and see that those were just, you know, two bumps that, you know, for half a year, you know, businesses were excited about the tax cut. There might have been some initial investment, but that's slowing. The growth rate of the U.S. economy is slowing. With the government shutdown, we're probably going to see even slower growth next year. But the main point here is that even though there's no signs of a recession on the horizon, that the economy faces some serious headwinds. You're seeing a decline in housing construction, which is usually a leading indicator of where the economy is going. So housing starts are down 11% over the last year. So that's a kind of a warning sign that growth is probably slowing. You're starting to see faltering consumer confidence. That's down 2%. Over the last year, which is not a huge drop, but that, you know, the big bump that came following the recession into Trump's election is starting to flatten out. The continued uncertainty about trade disputes with China, the continued uncertainty around Brexit, and now you can throw in instability with North Korea, perhaps.
And the tariffs.
That's what I meant with the trade dispute with China. So, you know, all of Trump's plans to, you know, make America first and raise these tariffs and, you know, promote U.S. businesses, we saw an increase in the trade deficit, not a decrease. So all of the policies that here's the bottom line, because I've been rambling about this and I could go on for another hour and 10 minutes if you wanted to. The bottom line is
that, as much as we love you, we do it.
Yeah, no, I know. so here's the bottom line. The U.S. economy is growing at a reasonably healthy pace, but all of the benefits that Trump has promised with more business investment, increasing exports to benefit American firms and workers, there's just no evidence of this in the most recent report.
Okay, so it's pretty much in the weeds, but here's the question for everybody, and that is the one thing that he really does have going for him in a re-election campaign is the economy.
That's true.
And the way that he has painted it and the way that people perceive it. Because, Aaron, as much as I love you, and I do.
I love you too, Alan.
Just like me, just like the president and Chairman Kim. No, really. It is amazing.
Which one's the dictator here?
Keep going.
You guess. So as we approach 2020, Aaron, the question is, will this economy get him through?
Well, economists have predicted 10 of the last 5 recessions, so probably not. I think based on some of the longer-term forecasts that I've seen and that have been produced is that what we're going to see is an economy that continues to grow but at increasingly slower rates. So he's not going to be able to point to a roaring economy like Clinton did in 1996, like Obama did during his reelection campaign. So will it be strong enough to carry him? Not by itself, but will it be a big mar on his campaign? Also probably not. Mm. Now, again, there's a lot of time between now and then, and the tariffs and the trade disputes with China, whatever is going to happen with Brexit, all of those are the big wild cards that a lot of investors and economic forecasters are looking at, and you just can't model that type of uncertainty. So if the Brexit deal goes horribly wrong or Trump doesn't sort things out with China and tariffs go up, that could be really detrimental to growth.
I was going to say that as much as we have reports and forecasts and dot, 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 a lot of this can change on a dime.
Oh, sure. I mean, if, you know, if the U.S. and China come to loggerheads on, you know, the tariffs, and, you see both sides pulling back and threatening each other, yeah, I mean, that could really turn the dial in the opposite direction really fast.
And conversely, if something good happens in China, mm-hmm. and we see it every time, every day, that something, even a breath of good news comes out of China, the market goes up.
That's true. But the market's going up because people are expecting the worst. So if you expect the worst and the worst doesn't happen, then that's a positive, but that's a positive from a really low bar.
So that's sort of Pacetti's law.
Sure. Expect the worst, and if the worst doesn't happen, then everybody's happy.
That's the way I live my life.
So, good stuff on the economy. Let's. I do want to talk about what has been happening over some other things that have been happening in the news, and then we'll go to a break and we'll take letters and move on. But the big story, of course, today is that the President of the United States ordered officials to give Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, you will remember, a security clearance. President Trump overruled concerns from intelligence officials and the top White House lawyer about giving his son-in-law access to sensitive information. This is according to four people briefed on the matter. The disclosure contradicts statements Mr. Trump made in January to the yep. Times in an Oval Office interview. I know, I was shocked too. So, what does it mean that Jared Kushner has the security clearance? And ultimately, what I keep wondering is, what does it mean about the security of security clearances? And I will go to the person who is one of the four of us in this conversation who actually has had White House security clearance. Judith Eng.
Right. It's pretty extensive to get your security clearance. They talk to everyone in your life. You submit reams and reams of financial information. In my case, looking at my financial data took about 7 nanoseconds. There wasn't much complexity there. But I think there's a lot of complexity around Jared Kushner's financial entanglements. I know a lot of the media coverage is focused on the president lying about this. There's an ABC interview with Ivanka Trump clearly lying about this. We now know that lying appears to be a genetic defect in the Trump family passed on from generation to generation. And I think the deeper issue here is, why were the career staff and John Kelly and former Chief of Staff John Kelly and former White House counsel Don McGahn, why were they all advising against Kushner having the security clearance? I think a lot of this is his relationship with foreign interests, his financial entanglements. You remember before the president took office, there was this bizarre meeting with Jared Kushner and some Russian interests that they tried to hide, going off-site, denying that the meeting took place. In fact, it did take place. So I think the deeper issue here is, what are the issues that led everyone except the president to say Jared Kushner should not have a security clearance? My understanding is that he doesn't have the highest level of clearance, which you get from the CIA, but it's quite possible that when he's in his father-in-law's office, he could look at the written material. And we know that his father-in-law doesn't read a lot. So for all we know, he's just handing the memos over to him. I also think it's another reminder about nepotism. Maybe you shouldn't have your son-in-law and your daughter working for you, because it may cloud your judgment in terms of what's in the best interest of, in this case, the country.
It's as if that's what really rises to the top in terms of Trumpian ideas. I mean, Stalin, when he was dying and everybody was celebrating but holding their breaths, they're apparently all in the room, and according to Khrushchev's memoirs, his toe just twitched and everybody went into panic. This guy is the dictator of the government. They're all scared to death of the guy. And if he says, you know, we're going to give this to him, what are they going to do? Say no, you can't have it? And where is their power to say no? They don't have it.
They don't. The president has the power. What I'm kind of disturbed by is that McGahn and Kelly were so disturbed by it, they did a memo to the file to protect their own interests when this blows up. But we're not so willing to make a bigger push to block this, especially Kelly, who is a general. You know, this is national security, and you don't have to have much of an imagination to know that both Kushner and Trump's are there for their business interests more than anything.
Do you think the concern from McGahn and Kelly, I mean, I'm sure the answer to this is both, but do you think it was personal to, oh God, don't give it to him, or just the norms of who should get clearance and not?
I think it's the latter. Yeah. I mean, when the career professionals, I mean, they probably had to take a really deep breath to be courageous and say, this guy should not have clearance.
Because that's going out on a limb for people working in the White House to say, you know, the president's senior advisor is not going to have top security clearance.
Do you guys think that when it's all over and done, a couple of letters to the file will protect their reputations for working with this guy?
No. And there are I want to know how many other letters to the file on there on how many other issues.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. Yeah. And really, that beyond that, there's nothing that can be done, right? He has the clearance. It's done. And you don't move from there.
Right.
Just wonder how it extrapolates to other people,
In a couple of years, we'll see some.
Or not.
Yeah. We'll probably see some interesting Kushner-Saudi business deal.
I've got a lot to say about that, so.
Okay, you have a minute. Or do you want to do it after the break?
One thing to say very quickly in a minute, and then
you'll defer to the second.
This is a huge blemish on the Trump administration that a senior advisor doesn't have this clearance. I mean, that is a gigantic scar on Trump's management abilities in terms of selecting the right personnel to make a seamless transition, to make sure people who are advising him have the right information. But let's remember that Trump doesn't really have management skills. He runs a business that's profitable by defaulting on bond payments and so on. He just, you know, his whole campaign was based on, I'm a deal maker. But, you know, being president requires management skills. And this is a huge blemish on his ability to effectively manage a team.
And he doesn't seem to be very good at making deals either.
Well, yes. And then we'll get to that later.
We'll get to that later. All right.
And I don't agree, so we'll certainly get to that.
Oh, good. That's a good part. All right. That was a teaser, ladies and gentlemen. That's what we call it in the business, a teaser. We will take a break. When we come back, we'll take your letters. We'll have Alan challenge Mr. Professor Pacitti, and then we'll go on and move on from there. We will be back. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Alan Chartok is here, Judith Enck, and Aaron Pacitti. And again, your letters are always welcome. Keep them short, keep them to the point, and we'd love to read them. panel@wamc.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. And when we last left you, Aaron, you were talking about some of your concerns on this.
Yeah.
Alan also had some concerns about your concerns. Alan, go ahead.
No, but first let's have Aaron
sort of recap
a precis so that you know I can remember what the hell it was all about.
Yeah, and me too, because I don't remember. Yeah.
So I was alluding to the fact that Trump's whole campaign was based on the fact that I'm a successful businessman. I'm a good deal maker.
I said he wasn't a good deal maker.
No, he's not.
I mean,
in a very narrow sense of the word, what I was saying is that his management skills in terms of how to surround himself with the appropriate people to give him unbiased advice and lay out, you know, different scenarios, he just does not have that skill.
Okay. So, you've been very articulate, as has the rest of the panel, on this issue. But remember, it's all about the base. You know, that doesn't change from day to day. I know I sound like a broken record. Do they care that he gave that information to his son-in-law? You know, a lot of son-in-laws in a lot of family businesses and things of that kind. So I'm thinking that while you are right that it's disgraceful, you are wrong in that it'll matter.
I kind of agree with that. It won't matter to his base. He could stab John Kelly in the neck, and I don't think his base would care.
It may not matter politically, but it certainly could matter in international relations. Kushner is over in the Middle East today, supposedly negotiating world peace once again. But he's quite cozy with the Saudi family. They stand by the very weak explanation on the journalist Khashoggi's death. And so Kushner may be doing all sorts of things that are not in the national interest that we may not know about for years. So it does matter in terms of day-to-day operation of the country.
Well, there's a bunch of eggheads sitting around a microphone and talking about, you know, what's right and what's wrong. You're absolutely right, both right. On the other hand, and I agree with everything you're saying, nevertheless, he's going to be out there negotiating with all these foreign countries, and how can you say to him, you can't know what information we have? Now, you don't agree with that. I don't agree with it. On the other hand, it is clear that this president and his toe are going to have their way. I mean, there's just no way around it.
Possibly. So here's my hypothesis.
There's one of your academic words which you keep throwing at people.
Okay. Here's my opinion. Was that better?
Here's my gut.
Yeah. Here's my take on the matter. So,
here's my sling of hash at the wall.
My guess as to why Kushner didn't have this clearance. I guarantee that there is overwhelming evidence that the Trump family's financial ties, specifically to Russia and Saudi Arabia, make both the president and Kushner and a lot, whoever else is in that circle, very susceptible to foreign influence. So,
Do you think?
I do, and here's why. Because
me too.
Remember, Trump has been, I don't want to say blacklisted, but his ability to borrow money from major international banks has been severely diminished. And to the extent that he can borrow, he's borrowing at higher interest rates. The loan tax return that the New York Times released showed a $96 million loss over 1 year. He's declared bankruptcy six times, once in 1990, 91, two times in 92, 2004, 2009. The Cohen testimony is now showing that he's inflated his wealth to make him seem more attractive to getting bank loans at more favorable interest rates.
And deflated his wealth when he wants to reduce his tax exposure.
Of course. Yeah, so that's
That's
a remarkable skill.
Then we're talking about the wrong thing.
No, hold on.
We should not be talking about Kushner and his information. We should be talking about taking it away from the president.
Sure. Yeah.
Of the United States.
There is the emoluments clause litigation that is slowly proceeding. They'll probably have that figured out in 3 years when it's too late.
So since Trump doesn't have access to lending at rates that would make his investments profitable, he's using his presidency, and Kushner's using his access to the president to essentially curry favor with Russian and Saudi oligarchs, because they have the money to fund these Trump projects that the private sector seems increasingly unwilling to fund. And in exchange, Russia wants the sanctions lifted and more freedom to operate. I don't know how to say this politely, just to take over the countries that Putin thinks are rightfully his. And then Saudi Arabia wants their, human rights records ignored. And they're just dangling money in front of these people saying, if you want this, we want this. And that's a remarkable amount of foreign leverage to put over the foreign interests have over the president and his senior advisor.
All right. We have letters. Let's go there and on many of the topics that we have discussed, and we'll move on to other stuff. Barry says, of course Trump will use the booming economy as a campaign speaking point, even though the growth is mediocre, per earlier discussion on the roundtable. When have any of his talking points related to the truth?
No, they haven't. I think so. I mean, that's the risk with an economy that's moving along more or less on average in terms of job growth, in terms of overall economic growth. It's not... he will use that to his advantage, and yes, it will not be totally factual.
My only point on that is there is what people read in the paper, and then it's what they experience in their daily lives. And, you know, there's been some discussion about people being shocked when they get their tax returns this year, and it's not what the president had predicted. Health care premiums are going up. College tuition is through the roof. Price of gas.
Wage growth is only now starting to pick up after a decade of being stagnant.
A lot of people are still juggling more than one job. So I think more than anything, people's personal economic insecurity will drive their view on the economy.
We got this letter from Russ, who writes, snowball diet. Interest due this fiscal year on the federal debt is $364 billion. Next year, 20% more. Which $100 billion of federal spending per year do we wish to replace with interest payments? Or where will we raise taxes? I don't see these questions being addressed now or in the 2020 election positions.
No. You know, Republicans say they're opposed to higher deficits because of the interest burden and the fact that it's going to, you know, rob future generations of money because taxes are going to have to go up. But, you know, they say that when Democrats are in office, and as soon as a Republican gets in office, they just blow up the deficit. So, and, yeah, there is no talk about that.
And then you look at someone like Mick Mulvaney, who was part of the Freedom Caucus, who, you know, that was the mountain he died on, was deficits. Yeah. And now
and same with Paul Ryan.
Yeah, yeah. Amazing.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is, I mean, just
don't confuse
Orwellian and hypocritical.
Don't confuse us with the facts, yeah.
Richard writes on the Kushner secret, getting good morning, panel. Kushner getting a security pass means that other governments will no longer see the U.S. government as a trustworthy recipient of secrets. Yeah. This administration enjoys making the world more dangerous by the day. As for security clearances, Catherine writes, all the memo for file accomplishes is demonstrating that McGahn and Kelly are cowards. Sad, very sad.
CYA.
And, yep. And this one for Judith. Regarding William Happer, could Judith comment on the White House's addition of known climate change denier William Happer to head a new climate change panel? Happy Friday, I think, says Derek.
Yeah, happy Friday. So Congress directed 12 or 14 federal agencies every few years to do a climate assessment, which scientists do and which actually came out under the Trump administration, and it was accurate and it focused on all the very real risks of climate change. The White House and their allies in the fossil fuel industry didn't like that. So the White House is doing its own panel that now we're told is going to meet in secret. And it's chaired by this gentleman who not only is a climate denier, but makes your mainstream climate denier look like Rachel Carson and John Muir combined. This guy is so far out there arguing that CO2 is good for us and there's no need to reduce fossil fuel consumption. He was just so isolated that no one took him seriously for his whole career of 30 plus years until this White House. So he is going to be in charge of, you know, this pretty hapless effort to challenge the scientists that work in the federal government on climate change. And it's very troubling.
This is so scary. I mean, this is so scary. How did this happen to us? How did this Alice in Wonderland scenario, it is so Kafkaesque. It is so crazy. And you wake up in the morning, and as we have often said, and Trump is still the president, we can't believe it. And then one insult after another happens. It's astounding.
And I think on climate change, you know, Trump is worse than any other federal administration ever in history.
Sure.
But the fossil fuel industry has a pretty firm grip on politics in Washington. You know, there it's not like, you know, there were comprehensive, effective policies. I mean, the Obama administration did some important things, but not enough, to be frank, in terms of confronting the real risks that are in front of us. The scientists are warning us that it's pretty bad, but it's the you look at the latest reports on melting ice caps in the Antarctic. You know, it's happening faster than anyone predicted. Locally, the writer Jeff Goodall, who we had at the WAMC panel on Earth Day last April, really accomplished writer. He writes for Rolling Stone. He spent the last 2 months, I think, up in Antarctica.
Right.
Talk about
still there, I think.
Yeah,
down in Antarctica,
going to an area where no one has gone before. It took him like 30 days to get there on this giant boat. I've been following his journey on Twitter. I am really looking forward to what he's going to write when he gets back, but the posts he's made so far, you know, these scientists are kind of freaking out about what they're finding.
I mean, the Department of Defense has created a contingency plan to deal with climate change and what the world might look like and how that's going to affect military strategy and foreign relations. Economists are now weighing in. I mean, they have been weighing in, but now it's really coming to the fore about the fact that climate change, I mean, when you talk about a slowing economy, that seems trivial relative to the fact that, you know, global warming is proceeding faster than people were predicting, that, you know, that's going to further slow growth because, you know, there's going to be, you know, whether it's a carbon tax, it's essentially going to be payback for polluting the environment, and that's going to depress growth. Like, I mean, it's just coming from every direction, and it's just mind-boggling to see an administration who's just like, yeah, well, so what?
And I think it's, I'm glad you mentioned that, Aaron, the Department of Defense. I think it was their critique on climate change and their investments in protecting their assets that inspired President Trump to do this alternative panel on climate science, which is just nuts.
All right. With the last words being just nuts, we will take a break and we will be back. We'll continue our conversation. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok is with us. We have Judith Enck, we have Aaron Pasitti, and we have your letters, panel@wamc.org. We will move on to other things in just a moment. Let me just we have a couple of letters that I still want to read that we haven't gotten to yet. Jay writes, while Alan is correct that the Kushner security clearance issue won't matter to the Republican base, it may matter along with all of the other scandals coming to light about the current occupant of the White House to some of the Democrats and independents who voted for him last time and will only take a tiny swing in the votes for the Democratic candidate to win the election.
I absolutely agree with that. I absolutely agree with that. I think that's exactly right. This election is going to be with a handful of people in a couple of key states. There are all kinds of calls for the reform of the Electoral College, but that's not going to happen. But there will be a lot of people who are disenchanted with this president. We saw that in the races for the House of Representatives, and that is, of course, he's exactly right.
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, I think a lot of the appeal of Trump, given the, you know, financial crisis and recession and the slow recovery, that people were looking for a populist outside candidate. And, you know, the Democrats had Sanders, but didn't run him. And people were just screaming for a populist candidate. So they figured, hey, why not try this guy? And after 4 years of, you know, scandal and this and that and the other thing, that it might be enough to sway a handful of, counties in key states.
Independents are exhausted by Trump. Yeah. I mean, I think the risk is people tune out, but some of the stuff is just so outlandish that you can't tune out. You know, we saw it with Michael Cohen's testimony this week. I mean, it's just going to continue. It's going to be a drip, 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 and at some point, maybe the public will see the Mueller report, and I think that should help define the issues of the campaign.
And by the way, panel, we got a letter from Mark, who wants to point out that we have not said a word today, although we sure have said words in the past, about the history-making story about the indictment of a sitting Israeli prime minister. Not a word about a story. Also yesterday, per Reuters, that the United Nations investigators said on Thursday Israeli security forces may have committed war crimes and crimes against humanity in killing 189 Palestinians and wounding more than 6,100 at weekly protests in Gaza last year. So I just wish, Mark, and others sort of like you, that you gave us credit. First of all, our news programs have been filled with this story.
Well, and it's the next story up on our docket.
Yes, and so, you know, give us a break, please. There's a certain smell to this that I'm not sure I'm comfortable with, but let's move on.
All right. We got this one from Maureen, who says, "Dear panel, I am so..." The subject line, which I do like, is "sick of the base." "Dear panel, I'm so weary of thinking about Trump's base. Focusing too much on the slowest, weakest-minded, most reactionary among us is regressive. Let's start thinking about the future, a world where our kids are competing in terms of education, in which we will be existentially impacted by climate change, in which people are deeply anxious because of the lack of affordable health care. We have work to do."
A good,
excellent.
It's all excellent. It's all on target, except for one small thing. Under the existing system, this guy is the president of the United States. And he is definitely counting on that same base returning him to office. Plus those people who like, Aaron, what's going on in the stock market right now, and who say, okay, my 401k is more important to me, you know, than the climate of this or the
sure.
way in which this country is going. And anybody who thinks that he couldn't be reelected president is off in la-la land.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that at all. But I think it's important, getting back to the writer's point, is
Maureen, that I should be writing this down.
It's really important that the Democrats in 2020 have a campaign platform more than, well, we're not Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the Green New Deal is a good step in the right direction. And it, politically viable or not, it kind of creates an outline and a platform. I think you see a lot of progressive Democrats that have been putting ideas on the table for a long time that just have gone nowhere, you know, declaring their candidacy. So, yes, there needs to be an alternative paradigm that the Democrats present that is more than just we are not Donald Trump.
Yeah. Jay Inslee apparently is announcing today, and we'll hear the big reveal from Beto O'Rourke, I think, in the next few days.
He's in, right?
Yeah, it seems that way.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
Okay. If you, I mean, you're being that coy, you're in, right?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So the it was number two on our docket. I just want to point that out.
Wait. There was another letter here, Joe. I'm reading it from an undisclosed location, which is why, of course, you're reading these wonderful letters from somebody who says, that basically the letter, here it is, from Dave. "What if Trump is impeached and refuses to leave the White House and calls on his base to support him?"
Oh, we talked about that yesterday.
I don't know, a military coup?
U.S. Marshals escort him out.
Yes. I don't think there's any evidence that the FBI or the national security apparatus would sign with Trump, would side with Trump.
No.
All right, so let's go to the Netanyahu story. "Netanyahu should be indicted on charges of fraud, bribery, and breach of trust, according to Israel's attorney general." Those are the recommendations from the attorney general. They have the case has been outlined against the prime minister in a 57-page letter sent to Netanyahu's lawyer. Israel's attorney general recommended Thursday that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu be indicted on charges of fraud, bribery, and breach of trust in connection with three corruption cases, casting uncertainty over his political future just 6 weeks before he faces an election. Netanyahu, who has strongly denied the allegations against him, now has the opportunity to present his defense at a hearing that makes a final decision on the indictment, but the recommendation indicates that top that Israel's top legal authority believes there is enough evidence to proceed with a trial. The legal challenge is a serious blow to Netanyahu ahead of the elections to be held on April 9th.
Yeah, he's got a very close election coming, and it may well tip the balance. There are many analyses which say that that we haven't had an indictment of a sitting president, that prime minister, I'm so sorry. That is correct. We haven't, but there are prime ministers who have been sent to jail after their terms in Israel. And it is interesting, always fascinating to me, the sort of distance and professional distance between the attorney general in that country and the prime minister.
And apparently the attorney general in Israel doesn't have the same guidelines that the United States Department of Justice has about not making anything, any kind of political announcement so close to an election.
From the Department of Self-Serving Guidelines.
Mm-hmm. But now, so you can draw comparisons if you wish, or you don't have to, but...
We wish.
Yes, but yeah. Netanyahu's response was to blame media, to blame his political enemies, to blame the people, to kind of cast blame on everyone else.
And witch hunt. Oh, don't forget that.
I'm surprised he didn't say witch hunt at some point.
I think he did.
Yeah, I think he did. Okay. And that it was fake news. So if that all sounds familiar, then it should.
Remember, this was a prime minister who was brought before a joint session of the United States Congress.
That's right. And is very much supported by our current president of the United States.
And Jared Kushner.
Yeah. Yes. It all comes full circle. All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll have more letters. We will have many more topics. And we welcome your input. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We will be back after this short break. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We have Alan Chartok, Judith Enck, and Aaron Pasitti. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org.
I have, Joe, if I can, an Aaron Pasitti question, okay. And that is, Aaron, help us all out, everybody with 401ks and everything else. Why does the market go up today 200 and something points?
Well, there's an infinite amount of forces that determine which way markets are going to move. You could have had abnormally strong corporate earnings from a few firms. Here's my hypothesis, Alan. That even the GDP report was good enough that it made investors confident that those headwinds that I was talking about aren't serious enough to really slow growth to a level that would make the market go down.
So here's a question. I'm sorry, Joe, for asking this, but it's something that occurs to me is important, and I have a feeling to many of our people. Is the class of major investors in the market basically more conservative? I think the answer to that is probably yes. More on the sort of Republican side than they are on the Democratic side. And therefore, when we see something like a 200 rise, it is something that expresses confidence in the president.
I don't think the president directly. I think, the U.S. economy is like a giant oil tanker, and that it's just a lot of times moves through inertia independent of presidential policies. Presidents have remarkably little influence on the economy. That's one of the dirty little secrets of economics, short of things like the New Deal or, say, World War II. I think investors are confident that the uncertainty surrounding the tariff talks with China, the Federal Reserve has made it clear that they're willing to and most likely going to put a hold on interest rate hikes, that these are signs that are going to show gains, but smaller gains in stock prices than what would happen otherwise.
Yeah, but oil tanker aside, I get the analogy. However, anything that China does or that the United States does with China that's positive from an investor's point of view, you find the market going up. And I mean, not turning the tanker around, but immediately.
Well, money can move around towards companies that are not going to be affected by the trade war with China. I don't think a full-blown trade war with China would be enough to tip us into a recession unless Trump right. really went off the rails. But like what he's proposing, increasing tariffs on everything to 25%, that's probably not enough to send us into a recession. It's probably enough that investors might get skittish and start moving money around away from goods that would be directly affected.
Huh. Okay.
All right. Let us move on. Like an oil tanker moving through inertia, I believe was the phrase, correct?
Yes.
Hopefully not the Exxon Valdez.
Yeah, right.
very nice. All right. Dolly writes and says the people in Trump's base will not be, I'm sorry, it's from Diana. My apologies. From Diana, the people in Trump's base will not be swayed in any upcoming elections because they are of the same mold, racist, misogynist, egotists. And here's a scary thought. What will Donald Trump and Jared Kushner et al. Do with our country's secrets when he is no longer in office?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, once you have a secret.
Yeah.
Yeah, once you tell one person, it ain't a secret anymore.
That's true. Kevin writes, Alan asked the right question. How did we get here? The next Ken Burns PBS series should be The Uncivil War, or how did we get to the point where we tune into the news on a minute-by-minute basis and everyone feels a part of it and acts accordingly, especially politicians? Luke has a question for Aaron. Lots of talk about the base today. How many in Trump country are getting jobbed by the new tax law and getting no refunds or paying more to the IRS? Any idea of the number and what effect it would have on swing states?
I have a codicil for Aaron. Well, it's a great question. The question is not whether or not it's accurate that people are getting screwed, but whether or not the people who are getting screwed know it.
Yeah, and they'll know it come April 15th when my wonderful wife did our taxes, and wow, did we owe a lot more than we did in the past few years. I don't know the numbers of who's going to face higher tax returns in Trump's base, versus who's actually going to get a higher tax rebate. But I think when people do find out that either they owe more or they're not getting the return they expected, that's definitely going to have some consequences because, Congress and Trump pulled a really clever trick, and that is they decreased withholdings from people's paychecks, so their paychecks got bigger on a week-to-week basis.
Right.
But when you do that, and you actually fill out your 1040 form, all of a sudden the amount of taxes you mm-hmm. owe mm-hmm. go up. So people probably don't recognize a paycheck that's, 5% bigger, a couple bucks, but they will notice when they have to write, a 3 or 4 figure check to the IRS in a month and a half. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that could affect the base's view on Trump.
Now, Aaron, Andrew Cuomo keeps telling us on our clandestine meetings on the radio, the reason that we're in this pickle is that the deductibility of state and local taxes happened, and that basically it forces people out of the state, and that's why New York's population is going down. No doubt about it, New York's population is going down, but it's been going down for years. And the simple explanation, it seems to me, and I don't want to sound like some arch conservative because I'm not, is that by providing services and spending a lot of money, the tax rate is there in New York. It is in Massachusetts, my fine state, which I live in. And the people and the weather. People want to go live in Palm Beach if they have accumulated a lot of money. So is the governor accurate that this one move by the Trump administration is what has resulted in New York's population going down?
Maybe for a handful of very wealthy people who will be affected by it. But the argument that income tax levels in states encourages people to move from high tax states to low tax states really isn't supported by a lot of economic evidence. I think it was the Cato Institute or one of the conservative think tanks published a study that said people's desire to move out of high tax states is growing, But your desire to move out of a high tax state is very different than your willingness to, you know, pack up and actually move, because in high tax states you have really solid provision of public goods. So if you look at states like Massachusetts, New York, and California, they have these, you know, wonderful public education systems, infrastructure to a certain extent. So, you know, low-tax states don't fund public schools. So if the wealthy want to move from a high-tax state where they're going to send the, you know, if they're going to send their kids to private college or private high school, it doesn't matter where they live. They'll move to South Carolina or Alabama, send them to ritzy private schools in high school, and then they'll send them somewhere else for college. So, yeah, I don't buy that. I don't buy that, except for maybe a handful of people. I mean, up here in Albany, people are very close to Vermont and New Hampshire, which are really low-tax states, mm-hmm. but you don't see that migration.
All right, we have just a letter or two, and then I want to move on to other stuff. Alan says, what hasn't been discussed are the many articles about Trump's dinners with Justices Thomas and his wife. Apparently Trump wants Thomas to retire so he can appoint another justice before he leaves office. Trump loves to hurt anyone who he sees as an enemy. What if Thomas resigns? Well,
good. Clarence Thomas? Bye-bye.
Yeah, but after the Kavanaugh incident, who knows who could replace him?
I don't think you get much worse than Clarence Thomas.
Well, the only thing is, Judith, you may not get worse than Clarence Thomas, but you may
younger.
Get younger.
Yep.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This is from Gary, who says, rich people and climate change. For us, bewildered, asking why these people in government don't care about climate change, it is obvious why it doesn't affect them. When their beach house gets washed away, they will build a new one. If food becomes prohibitively expensive for us, it is not for them. If social unrest caused by climate change is a problem for us, they will build walls and entire armies. Money insulates them from everything.
There was such a thing called the Russian Revolution. Remember that?
I think I heard of it at some point.
When things get really, really bad, and the 1% of 1% owns so much, which is why Franklin Roosevelt was such a brilliant man, because he saw it. He said, if there is such inequity in the country, you know, everybody, if you take somebody's house away from them, they're going to fight like crazy. So the communists hated Roosevelt because he saw the enigma, the problem. And the rich thought he was a traitor to his class. So the real question is, when do things get so out of hand in this country that terrible things will happen? And when I say terrible, we know what happens when the uber left takes over. I mean, the uber left. I'm not talking about liberals. I'm talking about people who put a Stalin into office and who rules the country for years and years to come.
So on climate, there is a phrase called climate justice and an acknowledgement that low-income people are disproportionately impacted by climate change. And I think Exhibit A is right here in New York in the Rockaways, how long it took to recover from Hurricane Sandy, and then certainly the tragedies that are still unfolding in Puerto Rico and the large numbers of people that are migrating because of sea level rise and hot temperatures. So it's it does affect poor people more significantly.
And yet, on my Fire Island, where I spent my youth and which figures so much in my thinking, you know, they said, okay, no building houses on the dunes, mm-hmm. but building houses behind the dunes, okay. So the question to you, Judith, is, what will people put up with, especially those people who have the most money, sensible rules are put in place? Because in my opinion, for whatever it's worth, and I did this as my 10th grade science project, Fire Island is going down, as are a lot of other barrier beaches mm-hmm. around the world. And how much will people put up with?
Yeah, well, 10th grade science paper was absolutely right. I mean, I think all this construction on barrier islands is in jeopardy. You know, one real problem is if homes are destroyed today because of weather, FEMA will pay to rebuild what was damaged by storms. So these houses are put back up all over again. And, you know, FEMA has been trying to change the rules for years, but Congress steps in because some rich guys or gals call and say, no, I need to be able to get funding to put my McMansion back up on a barrier island. But that is unsustainable. And I think in most coastal communities, you know, elected officials don't like to use this phrase, but there will be a retreat from the shoreline because you simply can't afford to put things back up over and over again.
Well, if the shoreline goes down in Fire Island, to take another example, what'll happen is Long Island will get the surfer crew because those waves are going right to Long Island. Then we'll see what happens.
Yep.
All right, let's go to the Trump-Kim summit and the collapse. And the article from the New York Times: over the past quarter century, three American presidents have tried cajoling, threatening, and sabotaging North Korea in its efforts to build a nuclear arsenal. Eventually, each turned to negotiations. President Trump was the fourth to test that proposition, but with a twist, engaging in the sort of direct talks that his predecessors shunned. As it turned out, it didn't work. The meeting in Vietnam ended in shambles on Thursday when Mr. Kim insisted on a full lifting of sanctions, according to Mr. Trump, and would not agree to dismantle enough of his nuclear program to satisfy American demands. The North Koreans later contradicted Mr. Trump, saying they had demanded only a partial lifting of sanctions, but they confirmed that they had offered to dismantle their main nuclear site. It's hard in this situation to know who to believe and who is more honest, and that is a disturbing thing, but yet true, right?
Yeah. Do you believe the dictator or do you believe the president of the United States? And there are very few people in the room who can confirm what or didn't happen. I mean, I really wanted President Trump to succeed on this mission. I think it was not surprising to most that he didn't, because he has to do it alone, and he's such a good deal maker. And
there was no work done in the
front in advance. I mean, this is not how diplomacy works. On one hand, I wanted him to succeed. I'm not surprised that he didn't. It's very interesting that I think he stayed up all night watching the Michael Cohen testimony. Was probably a little unhappy about that. And then we woke up to the news that this negotiation is over, done, prematurely, wouldn't even stay at the table for another day. And, I mean, it sure seems like the president was distracted by the Cohen testimony and just wanted to get out of Vietnam.
Yeah, but even if he wasn't distracted by it, I don't think the outcome would have been, I mean, maybe the summit would have gone the full length instead of ending early. But it's clear that Trump's just pursuing his megalomaniac goals and self-interest to be the one who, you know, the deal maker who finally does this. My gut tells me that Kim Jong-un is just playing him because he knows how to play a narcissist.
But it was just so bizarre. I mean, there was such a build-up to this. They're all over there. Just stay another day and try to keep talking. And then the president says, well, you know, you need to know when to walk away. After heaping praise on this dictator, and I feel so bad for the family of the college student who was tortured. And President Trump did his, well, Kim told me he didn't know about it, and those prisons are really rough. I mean, we've heard this over and over, giving deference to dictators, whether it's Russia, Saudi Arabia, North Korea, and not listening to the facts and to seasoned, you know, diplomats who know how to do these things. It's a joke.
Yeah, I think the North Korea thing's different than the Russia and Saudi Arabia, because I don't think Trump has any business interests in North Korea or sees that as a...
What I meant was the deferential. So, Saudi Arabia, we had nothing to do with Khashoggi's death. Well, he told me we didn't have anything to do with it. Putin, the Helsinki news conference. Well, Putin told me he didn't interfere in the election, so I believe him. I mean, this pattern of believing dictators over American intelligence information is really building up.
I think Trump wants to be a dictator and wants the admiration and adulation from actual dictators. And that's why he's just going along with it. He sees these, you know, strong men that have, you know, rule with an iron fist over their country. And I think he wants to be lumped into that category because of his narcissism and upbringing.
Right. And he fights with Canada and Mexico.
Yeah.
Well, we are just about out of time. We only have about a minute left. Any final thoughts from anybody?
I can't wait to see what happens with the Cohen testimony, because I think they're getting down into the weeds, and that's where you're going to see some real financial irregularities and people starting to distance themselves from Trump because they see lawsuits looming in the future, and you might see more people start turning in the near future.
I know you all discussed this yesterday when I listened in, but I thought Elijah Cummings' closing remarks at the public Cohen hearing were quite remarkable. And this morning, Elijah Cummings announced that he will do an investigation of the Kushner security clearance debacle.
Yes, but the one thing that bothers me the most about that, Judith, is the idea that Meadows and Cummings are best friends. We keep hearing that.
Meadows keeps saying that. Is Cummings confirming it?
Yeah, I think so. I think Cummings is saying he's really a good friend. It's a tough one. It's a tough one for me to imagine my saying to somebody who really is an off-the-waller, and Meadows is that, and mm-hmm. really outrageous,
right.
That he's a best friend. We're a very good friend.
All right, we'll end it there. My thanks to everybody. Alan, thank you very much. Judith Enk, always good to see you. Aaron, we'll see you all next week. We'll be back right after this short break.